on the simplest model of non-Fermi liquids. Okay, Senthil.
Great. Thanks, Ribu, and thanks to the PI staff for fixing all the problems. So let me just get started. So let me start with some background to elaborate a little bit on comments that I made at the beginning of the first lecture. So we're interested in non-Fermi liquid physics that occurs in a number of different materials. Now, a common phase diagram is one where if you, this function of temperature and some tuning parameter, it could be pressure, it could be a magnetic field or doping, you get a situation where you go from phase A to phase B. And in this region, in a wide range of temperature and tuning parameter, you get non-Fermi liquid physics. And sometimes there's some instability here, right? So when you look at a phase diagram like this and you say you want to understand this non-Fermi liquid physics, it's very natural to say that perhaps whatever causes the phase transition between phase A and phase B, the putative quantum critical point here, that that's what controls this non-Fermi liquid physics. As I said, that's one of the big reasons that I personally have for thinking about quantum criticality, okay? So the idea is that perhaps quantum criticality is responsible for the non-Fermi liquid. Okay. So let's, you know, and oftentimes one of these two phases will be an ordinary Fermi liquid, which we understand very well. So there's a crucial question that one can ask in such a situation. If we approach from the Fermi liquid, and the crucial question is the fate of the Fermi surface. As you reach the quantum critical point. Okay. Now there's two general possibilities that one should distinguish. So the terminology that I use may be slightly gory, but that would be applied to the Fermi surface. So I'll call these two possibilities. One of them I'll say is mutilate, and the other I'll say is kill. Okay. So in this first case, the Fermi surface evolves continuously but is distorted in some way. Across the transition. Okay. So for instance, one side could be a paramagnetic Fermi liquid, the other side could be a ferromagnetic Fermi liquid, in which case, you know, you have a separate spin up and spin down from the surface. But many other things are possible. And this usually happens if all you have going on is onset of broken symmetry. Now, there's this other situation where the Fermi surface is completely killed as you go through the phase transition. So the original Fermi surface completely disappears. And this happens, for instance, if you had a continuous Mott metal insulator transition. Where you start from a Fermi liquid, you do something to the system, perhaps you change the ratio of T over U in a Hubbard model, and you end up in a Mott insulator. The Mott insulator has no Fermi surface, while the metal has a Fermi surface. And these two things, if you can have a continuous phase transition, you have to lose the entire Fermi surface of the metal, right? And there's recent experiment showing that you may have such continuous Mott transitions. And there's variants of these in, which in models that are known in condensed matter as the condo lattice models. There's a phenomenon that is discussed a lot, at least phenomenologically, known as condo breakdown in these models. It's not very well understood theoretically, but so there's a so there's two totally different classes of situations that one should distinguish. One where the Fermi surface evolves continuously across the phase transition, and the other where the original Fermi surface completely disappears. And maybe you have a totally different Fermi surface on the other side, maybe you have no Fermi surface. But in any case, there's a much more radical change of the Fermi surface as you go through this transition.
Hi, Senthil.
Now, this, yeah.
This is Nandini here, question for you.
Hi, Nandini.
Hi. Yeah. So could there not also be a third possibility where the Fermi surface is not evolving continuously, but you can have some kind of fractionalization, and you can have a quote-unquote Fermi surface of a fractionalized object that is quite different from this original Fermi surface.
Right. That's subsumed into this category.
So the original electronic Fermi surface disappears.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's the thing that we can most easily get our hands on, right?
Right. Okay. So, thanks.
Yeah, sure. Now, to actually make progress on many of these problems where we see striking non-Fermi liquid physics here, we probably need to handle the second class of problems. Okay? That's sort of thinking that is popular in the field. And the state of our theoretical understanding of how to describe these transitions is extremely poor, and theories of these kinds of transitions are just in their infancy. There's a lot that we don't know, and the few examples that we do know of fit nicely with the sub-theme of this conference. The few examples that we do know of on how to describe such a transition all involve emergent gauge fields and matter fields that themselves form Fermi surfaces and so on. But for the most part, we don't really understand how to even write down a Lagrangian that will give rise to this kind of phenomenon, right? On the other hand, for this first class of phase transition, the framework to describe these phase transitions is extremely well developed. We simply focus on the vicinity of the Fermi surface, look at the electrons that live in the vicinity of the Fermi surface and couple them to critical fluctuations of the Landau order parameter that characterizes the broken symmetry. Okay, so in this case, we have a good framework to get started. We know how to write a Lagrangian. In this case, we hardly know how to write a good Lagrangian to further analyze. Right? So in this first category, where things are in much better shape, even though we know how to write the Lagrangian, we don't quite know how to solve that Lagrangian, right? And there's been a lot of literature in the last 30 years trying to attack that problem. And there's been some level of understanding of how to deal with this situation, that of a Fermi surface coupled to a critical order parameter field. But we don't really have a completely satisfactory understanding. And one of the things I'm going to do in the rest of this talk is to focus on this class of phase transition and talk about some recent results where we were able to obtain some exact critical properties for this class of phase transitions in a non-perturbative way. So let me just focus on this story for the rest of the talk. I'd love to be able to do the same thing for the second category of phase transition, but given that we don't, to a large extent, we don't really know how to even get started. Right? So it's not ready for more detailed analysis at this stage. Okay, so let me give you examples of this class of problem. I already said the onset of a broken symmetry. Now, one example that is discussed a lot in the kinetic matter literature is you take a metal on a 2D square lattice, and go through a QCP associated with breaking C4 rotation symmetry to C2. So this is often in the literature called an isognomatic phase transition. QCP. But there's many other broken symmetries that you can imagine. Now what I'm going to restrict to in this talk are situations in which the broken symmetry is such that you still preserve translation and charge U1. Right? So you might break other symmetries of the system. You might break spin rotation, you might break lattice rotation. You might break time reversal or inversion, but you preserve that the ordering occurs at zero crystal momentum. Okay. Now, a closely related problem, a problem that's closely related to this example, is the problem of a Fermi surface of some objects coupled to a U1 gauge field. So in the kinetic matter context, this model arises quite frequently. Example in the theory of the half-filled Landau level. So there's a lot of good motivation to study this problem as well. Now, there's many attempts to control this theory. In the last 30 years. And we have a lot of insight into what happens at low energy, but not a satisfactory understanding. The new development that I want to talk about, or exact results for some universal properties. Not all, but some. Let me give you some examples of things that we can determine exactly. So there are two key words in this sentence. It's exact results, but it's exact only for universal properties. So in other words, we're able to calculate some properties of the fixed point exactly, but we can't calculate exact properties of some lattice microscopic model, which will include all kinds of, corrections from irrelevant perturbations and the fixed point. Okay. So examples will be, we can determine the boson propagator. So the boson here is the, I should say that the model is Fermi surface less critically fluctuating. Boson, which is the Landau order parameter for the broken symmetry. Or it could be the gauge field in the problem of the Fermi surface coupled to the U1 gauge field. Okay? So what can we calculate? So we can determine the boson propagator, which is obviously of importance. But we can't determine it in general, but we can calculate it as a function of frequency at zero momentum, okay? And the answer is very simple. The answer is that this is just some number, which is a constant independent of frequency, okay? And we can relate this number to parameters of the model. Another quantity that is of physical interest is the optical conductivity, sigma of omega, right? So the real part of sigma of omega, the thing that's measured in an absorption experiment, we can show that at the fixed point, it is just proportional to a delta function with a coefficient that is a function of this number pi naught, but is otherwise frequency. I mean, it's otherwise trivial, right? So critical fluctuations alone do not give you a non-trivial resistivity at the fixed point in this class of modules. We can calculate some thermodynamic susceptibilities. For instance, as you approach from the Fermi liquid, these n thetas that are introduced in the previous talk, the quasi-particle number at each point theta of the Fermi surface, so you can calculate the susceptibility of these n thetas. So there's an n theta prime. And this object is something that's given by the non-interacting value, right? Which depends on the inverse of the Fermi velocity and delta function. So this is the value you would get in free fermion theory. Plus a correction, which involves some function of theta and theta prime, which we can calculate, divided by mc squared, where mc squared is the mass of the boson field. In other words, this is the distance from the critical point. Right. So this, again, is an exact universal result. So the question is, how are we able to do these things? Right? You know, what's the magic that enables us to get exact fixed point answers in a theory that is obviously very, very complicated? Okay. And the answer as to what enables us is that these are gifts that we obtain by thinking about the emergent symmetries and the anomalies of the fixed point. Okay, so we call them gifts from anomalies. So the strategy for progress, that for this progress, is the first step is to identify the emergent symmetry and anomaly of the fixed point theory. And the second step is to exploit these. Once we identify this emergent symmetry and the anomaly, we'll exploit the structure of this anomaly to obtain constraints on the IR properties. As you can see, the strategy turns out to be very powerful for some quantities whose universal singularities we can just okay. Let me illustrate the strategy with a couple of simple examples, which are hopefully, you know, understandable to everybody listening. Before turning to the model at hand, to the problem at hand, and applying the same logic to that problem. Okay. So let me illustrate with a couple of examples. The first is, let's return to the simple 1D interacting fluid of fermions. Okay, so this I talked about in the previous lecture as well. So there is some dispersion, epsilon k, as function of k, and there's some chemical potential that's sitting here, and we linearize the dispersion near the two Fermi points and get a Dirac theorem. Okay. So the IR theory is a massless Dirac fermion, perhaps with some four fermion interactions, which gives you a fixed line. And we know that the global symmetry with GIR equals U1 plus U1, corresponding to conservation, separate conservation of left and right movers. Okay? Now, we also know the anomaly equations in this problem. It's the axial anomaly. And so in an electric field, in an external electric field, we know that d mu, j mu, right, is E over 2 pi, and d mu, j mu, left, is minus E over 2 pi, okay? And as I did in the previous lecture, we can integrate these equations over all of space and find the rate of change of the number of right movers and the number of left movers. So d n right dt is e l over 2 pi, and d n left dt is minus e l over 2 pi. Okay. So now I want to ask what happens to the conductivity, the electrical conductivity in this model. Right. So the electrical current J the spatial component of the electrical current, Jx, is the Fermi velocity times the n right minus n left, okay, divided by L. Okay. That's simply telling you that a quasi-particle at the right Fermi point carries a current Vf times the its electric charge. At the left Fermi point carries a current minus Vf times its electric charge. Okay. So we can look at the rate of change of J in an electric field, and this is Vf over L dt of n right minus nL. And using these anomaly equations, we can substitute those here, and we get that this is simply Vf over pi times E. So the current simply increases linearly in external electric field. So Fourier transforming with minus I omega J of omega is Vf over pi E of omega, which means the conductivity sigma of omega is I Vf over pi omega, or the real part of the conductivity is Vf over pi squared times delta of omega. Okay. So based on the anomaly, we get this relation that the conductivity is just a delta function. Okay. Now, there's other ways of deriving this equation. In this very simple system, we can just go back to the UV theory and use some momentum conservation or something to derive this result. But it's instructive to derive it purely from the point of view of a low energy theorist using the low energy effective field theory. And the low energy effective field theory, this result comes about as a consequence of the anomaly equations. Right? So the anomaly has enabled me to calculate the conductivity in an exact manner in this theory. Okay, so that's the first illustration of the power of the anomaly. Now the second illustration is a bit more non-trivial, but still hopefully familiar. The model is at least hopefully familiar to everybody listening. And this is the model known as the Schwinger model in 1 plus 1D. It's this, the one of the simplest gauge theories. So the action, it's QED2, massless QED2. So the action is integral of a Dirac, it's a Dirac fermion coupled to a U1 gauge field with some coupling constant G. So this is the action for the Schwinger model. Now, the difference from the, I'm just going to think about this as a field theoretic model and not worry about its origins from some condensed matter system. Right? Now, the difference from the previous example of the Dirac fermion is that now I've gauged the global U1 symmetry with by coupling in a dynamical U1 gauge field. Okay. So now there's still the anomaly equation, which relates. So this model, so in the previous model, I had an toothed anomaly that told me that the global symmetry of U1 cross U1 was violated in the presence of external electromagnetic fields. Now in the present model, my anomaly equation, I'll have an anomaly equation that's intrinsic to the theory. I don't need to couple in external background gauge fields. I already have an internal dynamical gauge field. And so the anomaly tells me that d mu, j mu l is 1 over 2 pi f, and d mu, j mu right is minus 1 over 2 pi f. Okay? Okay, as before, the current, the fermion current in this model, J, so here, in writing this equation, I've set the Fermi velocity to 1. I'm just using a relativistic notation. So the J is, J0, right? That's right. So J0 right minus J0 left, right? And as before, by taking the derivative of this, I can write an equation and we get dj dt equals the electric field E over pi. So E equals the electric field of the U1 gauge field. Well, let's pick a gauge. Let's choose A0 equals 0 and AX equals AX of T. So then the electric field gets related to the time derivative of AX. And we get ddt of j plus ax over pi is equal to 0. Okay? So we can identify, we get one equation where j can be identified with minus ax over pi up to a constant. Now we also have the equation of motion, namely Maxwell's equations, right? From the equation of motion of ax, we get another equation, which is that the time derivative squared of AX, so this is really the proportion of the time derivative of the electric field, that this is equal to G squared times j, which is, we can basically equate to minus d squared times ax over pi. Okay? Now, if we add a source, so these are the equations of motion in the absence of external sources. If we add a source, minus hx ax to calculate correlation functions. This implies the equation of motion changes to dt squared ax plus g squared over pi ax is minus hx, which then tells us that the a propagator, ax propagator, bxx, at omega, as function of omega at q equals 0 is 1 over omega squared minus g squared over pi. Okay? So this is, of course, a familiar result. And one way of stating this is that the irreducible polarizability of this gauge field, the boson self energy, is simply g squared over pi, independent of frequency. So this is a familiar result to many of you. In current span of physics, people will say that the gauge field has now become a plasmon. Quantum field theorists say that in the Schwinger model, the gauge field applies a mass. But we derive this here. The point of view of presenting it this way is that we see the structure of how this is a direct consequence of the anomaly of the Schwinger model. Okay, so I want to apply this kind of logic. So apply this kind of logic to 2D Fermi surface plus critical boson. Right, so that's what we want to do. Okay. So the physics part, so let me give you a little bit of background on this problem, right?
Sorry, Senthil has a question from where? Excuse me, Ijan?
Yeah.
There is a, right here. This will come behind you.
Oh, okay. Senthil, can you just go up your, this is sort of related to the question I asked before. Yeah, not so much. That one, the derivative of j plus ax, is zero. Now, the question I had before in your first lecture was the ax of t that you wrote down, it's minus infinite and t at plus infinite, at best are only related by a gauge transformation. It can wind. It looks like somehow that has to play a part. I don't quite see how. It has to play a part either in lack of clustering or something like that, which is what you are relating as your result. I mean, in the Schwinger model, when Schwinger did it, he didn't worry about all the topological sectors. But if you worry about all the topological sectors, then sort of the long distance behavior gets mapped onto not a condensate, but an expectation value for psi bar psi that comes from gauge field topology. Sure. I don't know where that played a part here.
For this part of the story, that doesn't really play a part. But, there are other ways. There are more powerful things you can do with the Schwinger model, which enable you to extract all kinds of other results in which that will definitely play a part. For instance, you can bosonize this theory and relate this to, in the bosonized version, you can explicitly see the effect of these distinct topological sectors associated with the winding of the flux of the U1 gauge field. Right? So you can do all of those things.
Right? But what you're calling as anomaly is the same as that. So it should be possible to derive what you did just by saying the same thing about global topology.
Yeah, no, it's true that you can think about global topology with a lot of benefit in this problem. But what I'm saying is that I'm sort of giving you a lowbrow treatment, which is something we can generalize very easily to other problems. Right? Nothing that I say is inconsistent with any consideration based on global topology. It's all part of the same package.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say it was inconsistent. I was wondering how to see the other side. That was my question.
I mean, to do that, you have to go that if you really do a fully quantum treatment of the model, you will have to sum over different topological sectors of the U1 gauge field. Right? And in a sense, the bosonization procedure automates all of that. And so then you just get, you know, in bosonization, you just get the answer. I mean, I'm happy to go over the bosonization route to the same answer, maybe at the end of the talk.
That's okay. That's okay. That's fine. Thank you. Thank you.
Sure. Other questions?
Yeah, Santo. So can I, is it true that even if the gauge field is non-compact, meaning it's R, your whatever you did still go through?
No, it's not really compatible, I think, with, you know, I do have a quantized electric charge, and my electric charge is a discrete integer, right?
Well, really... the model doesn't really require that, right? Suppose you don't put in Dirac quantization. I mean, your low energy field.
You could ask about a different model, but this is the model I'm studying, right? There's a single fermion field with discrete electric charge. You could ask questions about a different model in which I have two different fields whose ratio of charges is not the rational number or something.
No,
that's a different model. Let me not worry about that model.
But here your low energy degree of freedom carries integer charge doesn't necessarily require the gauge field itself to. I mean, you could have all sorts of different UV completion.
Yeah, I mean.
But since you're only using equation of motion here, I don't see how the compactness really play a role.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess the point is this: right? So my global symmetry is a global U1 symmetry. It's not an R symmetry, and then I've gauged it with the U1 gauge field. Now you could ask, if you know, what happens if you allow me to gauge it with an R gauge field? I don't know. I haven't really thought about that in detail.
All right. Okay.
Maybe thanks. That's what you're asking, right?
Yeah, I think the anomaly equation is also true even if it's R. But yeah, we can leave that to later.
Yeah. Then maybe this relates to what Rajaman was asking. Okay. Other comments?
Hi. Would you please explain why you considered the source term, HX?
Oh, just to get the correlation function. You know, in the action, we would get the correlation function by differentiating twice with respect to the differentiating partition function twice with respect to the source term. Equivalently, from the equation of motion, we just read off the response function, and that gives me the propagator.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure. Okay. So the model, so the microscopic model, again, one could imagine this as being on a lattice, but the fermions with some dispersion. Coupled by some Yukawa coupling. To a boson that is tuned to be massless. So this boson could be the order parameter of a broken symmetry or it could be a U1 gauge field. Now, you can take a quick look at this problem. And this has been done for decades by now. So as a preliminary look, you can just try to do perturbation theory, right? And there's a boson self-energy that you can calculate in perturbation theory. It will involve this diagram, right? And when you calculate it, you'll find that the boson self-energy goes like mod omega over Q. So this phenomenon known as Landau damping for imaginary frequency. And it gives you, it overdamps the dynamics of the boson. Now the fermion self-energy can also be calculated in within this so-called RPA theory, where you use the renormalized boson propagator and you calculate this diagram, right? And this gives you a fermion self-energy that goes like omega to the 2/3 times sine of omega. And this tells you that the Fermi liquid is destroyed. So this model has long been understood to not be a Fermi liquid, right? And the question is, can we control the resulting non-Fermi liquid physics of this model? Okay. So there's a long history of attempts to control the IR physics. And it goes, you know, first there's these perturbator calculations done a long time back. People tried to generalize the number of fermion species to large N and then control it. But as PI faculty member Seung-Sik Lee pointed out in 2009, the standard large N expansion is uncontrolled. Or rather, it's hard to control it. There are some infinite number of diagrams. And people have attempted all kinds of things, but nothing fully satisfactory as of today. And maybe that will change, but as of now, we don't know. Okay, now, what's the physics that we, what's the crucial physics of this model as revealed by all these prior attempts to understand what's going on? So the crucial physics input that we need is that the critical boson can only scatter fermions by a small angle. So the boson, its dangerous fluctuations live near zero momentum. So it can give you only very small angle scattering of fermions near the Fermi surface. So the strategy, again, it's an old strategy, but we're going to divide, I used to call this divide and rule. We divide the Fermi surface into small patches and couple each patch to the boson. So we have a Fermi surface and we divide it up into a lot of tiny patches. Eventually we'll take the number of patches going to infinity and the patch size going to zero. So I'll define an action for this theory. I'll call this the mid-IR action. So this won't be the true microscopic model, but it's already coarse-grained to the vicinity of the Fermi surface. And this mid-IR model, I'll write as a sum over two actions. One is a sum over patches, a patch action as a function of theta, and the other is the action of the boson phi. Okay? Now, this patch of theta will be written as an integral over t and x of a fermion field that lives on each patch theta with its standard time derivative term, and a dispersion by Vf of theta W hat of theta dot gradient. This represents, so W hat is the normal to the Fermi surface. So this represents the dispersion perpendicular to the Fermi surface. And another piece, which is 1/2 pi j of theta di d theta of psi theta. So this W hat is the normal, the Fermi surface, and this kappa ij is the numbers that capture both the curvature of the Fermi surface and the curvature of the dispersion. And along with, in this patch action, there's a Yukawa coupling, which couples with some possibly theta-dependent function, coupling constant g, which couples phi of theta, psi bar theta, psi theta. Okay, so that's the first part of the action. And the second part of the action is the boson action, and it's a standard theory of bosons, right? So it'll have some boson kinetic term. And a tuning parameter, nc squared, phi squared, where we're going to tune, at the end of the day, we're going to tune nc squared. The renormalized value of nc squared is zero, so that we have a critical boson. Okay, so this is what I'll call the mid-IR model. It's a coarse-grained version of the microscopic model, and the expectation in the field is that this sort of mid-IR model will flow to the true fixed point if we could actually solve it. Okay, now I should point out that this boson, that this boson phi, in principle, couples to all, the same boson phi couples to all patches of the Fermi surface, right? It's just that the patch action, the fermions live, can be separated into separate patches along the Fermi surface. So let's look at the global symmetry of this model. So I said my strategy was to look at the global symmetry and the anomaly. The global symmetry is that the fermions in each patch are conserved. The fermion number in each patch is conserved, right? And you might imagine that correspondingly, the actual symmetry action is given by psi of theta goes to e to the I alpha of theta psi of theta. Okay, let me put a question on this. So that's the naive expectation, but this naive expectation, just like in the Schwinger model, is false. And that's because the coupling to the boson makes this anomalous. It's very much like in the Schwinger model. And the reason is that each patch looks like a chiral fermion. And this term here, this looks like the coupling of a gauge field to this chiral fermion. Okay? In fact, one can make that precise and derive an anomaly equation just like before. So dt and theta plus divergence j theta equals minus lambda patch over 2 pi squared times g of theta over vf theta dt phi. Right? So you should think of the right hand side as the analog of the electric field. And the left hand side is just the left hand side of the continuity equation. So clearly, this means the correct conserved charge is not n theta, right? It, just like in the Schwinger model, it's deformed from n theta by a term that depends on the boson field, g of theta over v of theta times phi. Right? So you take this right-hand side to the left-hand side and combine the time derivatives. Now let's look at what happens to this equation at q equals zero. At q equals zero, I can forget about the divergence of j theta. I simply get dt of psi theta dagger psi theta equals minus lambda patch over 2 pi squared g of theta over vf theta phi. Okay, dt phi. This is analogous to the equation that we had in the Schwinger model, where dt of j was proportional to dt of ax. But let's play the same game now as in the Schwinger model. Right? We'll look at the equation of motion for the phi field. So I get lambda dt squared plus mc squared phi plus sum over theta g of theta psi theta dagger psi theta plus some source term h of t. Right? So this is the source term that I introduce in the action to calculate correlation functions. And I can Fourier transform this and look at it at q equals zero. And I get minus lambda omega squared plus mc squared phi, mc squared plus phi times phi of q equals zero omega equals h of omega, where pi, equals sum over theta lambda patch over 2 pi squared g of theta squared over the f of theta.
Hey Senthil.
Yeah?
Just want to check in with you on time.
My goodness. What time is it? I haven't been keeping track.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had sort of scheduled 45 minutes, so we should have finished about 10 minutes back, but...
Oh really? I'm so sorry. Yeah.
No. We're having a great time. But I just wanted to check with you how much time you'd need.
I can finish in a couple of minutes. Actually, I'm basically that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can have a little bit more than that. But we should wind up soon because I think they have some plans.
Yeah. No. I think 2 minutes is a good place to stop instead of flooding you with more information.
Oh, take your time.
Yeah, so this then gives for me the propagator of the fermion. So d phi is 1 over minus lambda omega squared plus mc squared plus pi. And this d phi at q equals 0 omega, right? Now, the leading IR behavior simply comes from this. And this is a subleading correction. So therefore, d phi q equals 0 omega at the fixed point is 1 over mc squared plus pi. Now, there's a question of what the value of mc squared is to place the system at criticality. And I won't argue this now, but can show by considering d phi at q going to zero, omega equals zero, you know, that determines the susceptibility, the other order of limits, that critical point is at mc squared equals zero. So therefore, d phi q equals zero, omega at the fixed point is 1 over pi equals a constant independent of frequency. Right? So this is one of the results that I advertised right at the beginning. And I've shown you how some very simple considerations based on anomalies leads you to the subject. Now, so the other thing that I mentioned are things like the optical conductivity and so on. In a few more steps, you can derive the optical conductivity as well. And the further arguments along these lines, and then you can derive the susceptibility. That's all I should say. Let me stop here. I hope this convinces you of the power of thinking about emergent symmetries and anomalies to actually calculate properties of these non-trivial fixed points.
Okay. Yeah, I'm done. Hello, can I ask a question now?
Sure, yeah. Jenko, why don't you ask a question?
Yeah, so at the beginning of the talk, I mean, it was the last half of the first half of the talk. Actually, you mentioned you're going to talk about compressible state with finite compressibility. And yeah. Later, there was a discussion about anomaly. And I think in your paper, you showed the anomaly will lead to the peak. So I wonder whether one can establish a relation between the peak and also the compressibility without going through much of the technical derivation there.
Yeah, so first of all, so good. So maybe I write a couple of equations in answer to your question, Kinky. So quite generally, so the real part of the conductivity will have some Drude weight times delta function plus various incoherent parts. Now, quite generally, this Drude part can be written as a sum over all operators O, which are conserved. And chi j o, schematically, chi j o squared divided by chi o o. Okay. Now, what the anomaly arguments buy for me is the statement that there exists these emergent conserved quantities O for which this overlap with the current chi j o is not necessarily non-zero. That chi j o turns out to be related to a quantized anomaly coefficient. Okay, so this does not imply necessarily that there's a Drude peak, because there's a further assumption that's needed that the denominator is finite, right? And in fact, there's a loophole between this association between compressibility and Drude weight. And the loophole is precisely that compressibility only implies the numerator is non-zero. It doesn't tell you anything about the denominator. If the denominator diverges, you may not have a Drude peak. And we can construct very concrete.
I haven't seen why compressibility would imply chi j o being non-zero.
Oh, because I didn't explain that. I'm just stating that this statement we can provide. We can provide a physics level proof for in d bigger than one and d equals one. My wonderful colleague Dominic came up with a rigorous math level proof. So the anomaly, so the general statement that in the compressible phases that the low energy theory has some emergent continuous symmetry with an anomaly tells you that the corresponding conserved quantity, its conservation law, is violated by external electromagnetic fields. And that you can show then directly implies that this cross susceptibility KJO is non-zero and is proportional to this quantized anomaly coefficient.
Hey, Shankar,
let me just say one last thing to Shankar before I continue.
I think it's related.
Yeah, but let me just say this and then I'll come back to you. So
okay.
There are very concrete models that one can write down, which have U1 and lattice translation symmetry, and which are compressible in the IR, but do not have any Drudy weight at all. D is zero. And the mechanism for that is just what I talked about, where the denominator goes to infinity. Sorry, Lijun?
Yeah, yeah. I just want to confirm where the K's dimension is.
You can make it dimensionless. You can pull out dimensions.
But what you said is given by the anomaly coefficients. Anomaly coefficients are supposed to be dimensionless.
Yeah. So in natural units, after you pull out the right dimensions, then it's just some number. Right? Okay. Now pull out the flux quantum and set electric charge, H bar, and all those kinds of things to one.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, Senthil, since we're running so late, we have a question for you, actually. Since we were expecting you to come here in person, we have a moderated discussion in the evening at 5:15. Is there any chance that you'll be able to join us for an hour?
Sure, I would love to.
Okay, great. So then I'll tell you what, since we have, there are other questions, and there'll probably be more questions on the other talk, maybe that would be a good time when we can ask you some more questions, if that's okay.
I'd love to participate.
Okay, great. So then it's on the schedule, and it'll be great if you join, and then we can have some broader discussions of all these interesting points. Okay, so let's stop over here since we're already running very late, and let's thank Senthil so much, despite all these difficulties, giving this great talk.
Thank you.